I say this to every person who walks in my door professionally, but the thing that I keep coming back to is connection is king. So it doesn't matter what we do as much as if we're doing it in a connected way. And what I mean by that is actually be present with your child. When you're talking to them, are your toes and your nose facing the child? Or are you trying to do something and looking over your shoulder and just kind of like, try, it feels brushed off. Connect with your child, put down your own devices and actually have a conversation. If your child doesn't want to talk, just sit next to them. Just have connection with them. That is the biggest advice that I can give that makes an almost immediate impact.
Our children are leaving the faith in droves.
As a result,
oh, I got a pause here.
We're going live right now.
How can we raise our kids to stand firm, have a faith that lasts, and navigate such a time as this?
Our nation's capital has just been.
To turn a nation, you have to take the next generation.
Today in the news, COVID-19.
I'm Jake McCandless, and this is my podcast, Stand Firm Parents. We're working together to help our children have a faith that lasts.
And now, here's Jake McCandless.
Has the suspense been killing you? A week ago, we started part one, our conversation with Temple Carson, a therapist, sharing her experience in the clinic and sharing the research behind the book, The Anxious Generation, and talking about emotional health and our kids. So we've talked about hello to emotional health regarding ourselves, but now we're pointing it to our kids. An important conversation that we stopped in the middle of. Remember I told you, I've been getting word my episodes been getting a little too long. So I'm just said, fine, I'll just cut them in half. So that was part one. This is part two. There's a link in the comments or in the notes somewhere, wherever you're viewing this or listening to this, that will send you back to part one. You need to catch this. It's an incredible episode. But here it is. Part two, my conversation with Temple Carson.
So I think all of us are familiar with the idea of a helicopter parent, which came from an organization called Love and Logic Parenting. And it's the idea that you had a hovering parent who always wanted to be there to help the child.
Yeah.
And so we're pretty familiar with that concept. Well, at a certain point around, I think right before COVID, and I think it has escalated since COVID, that wasn't really good enough anymore because that was pretty mild for what we saw some parents doing. We saw a lot of parents who were doing what we call, or what I call, lawnmower parenting. And what it is that parents who come down just like a lawnmower on grass and just cut everything down. So there's absolutely no stumbles that your child is going to hit. They fill in all pitfalls for them before they have a chance to experience them. And so that's kind of the idea of lawnmower parenting, is making sure that there's nothing, no challenges in the way.
That name just blew me away. I hadn't heard it until you mentioned it. And so, but that picture, I think it's big. And I would say probably for many of parents listening who are very intentional, many, many are homeschooling Christian parents, that safetyism may even be higher in a Christian home than others. Is that possible?
Yeah, it's possible. I think there's good reasons for that, but I've definitely seen that trend.
So that sounds like a wild storm talking about, I mean, that idea of, my generation, I think I got internet at home my senior year, the summer after my senior year, and at school, I think we got it where you could actually get on it my junior and senior year of high school, but it was dial-up, and so you were limited even your time that you could spend on it, or the bill's going to get crazy and all those things.
You've got mail.
Right. And so, the problem was late night getting on a chat room or something like that. But then the access to have that all in your hands sounds like a perfect storm. I had read a lot of excerpts and quotes from the book and was familiar. And I know there's a lot of talk about the anxious generation. It blew me away to hear you say, when we were preparing for this, to say that, hey, this was the previous generation. So we've had COVID, we've had phones that are bigger screened, more access, so many
more social
things.
Media platforms. Sure. And I think that's a valid point, because what we had was, we had this whole generation that was being set up for anxiety, and then COVID hit.
Yes.
Which was not just in your homes and in your towns and cities, but it or nationwide, it was a worldwide anxiety epidemic.
Yes.
There were other things going on, but from my point of view as a mental health clinician, anxiety was rampant and hopelessness, and there was so much fear and anxiety at that time. And so we came in primed to just kind of fall into this trap. And I believe fall we did. There was after COVID, we're still seeing signs today of the after effects of COVID. There's a lot of research happening right now about the after effects of COVID that's going to be coming out in the next 10 years, hopefully. But we have lots of children who not only were anxious and bored. And so, kids need to connect socially. So they're anxious and bored and they have a phone in their hand. And then on top of that, we also had parents who are incredibly anxious and bored and trying to cope. So we had children on phones and children, quote unquote, going to class, but not really going to class or
Right,
just
yes.
sitting there. And so we had everything just kind of halted for about 2 years. And so that includes the social and emotional development of children halted for about 2 years. And we're still seeing the after effects of that.
Wow, it just seems like a perfect storm. But as you're saying that, in many cases, you had parents maybe that were at home with their kids that weren't previously at home, but
Yes.
they're both at home and both in devices. That seems like that would also be detrimental as well.
Yes. So we had lots of parents who were on devices as much as children. So we had lots of togetherness, but not a lot of connection.
Wow. So we've got this perfect storm. It was building and then it grows from that. Just incredible. So he talks about this in the book, talks about how much it is. It's growing. You've seen it. Now I want to talk about some practical steps for parents. And one that I think we probably ought to start with because of your knowledge and your experience. I think there's probably a lot of parents who are like, how do I know that my child would benefit from therapy, needs therapy? How do you know that?
Sure. So there's lots of answers to that that can go into a lot of detail. But the rule of thumb is that if the problem is bigger than what you feel you can handle, it's time for professional help.
Okay, that sounded too easy.
I
So,
know.
because I'm thinking, as a parent, I may be feeling like I could just get stronger. I can just, because a lot of times you could, like, I think with emotional health, as a parent, you may not realize how deep the problem is. Is
Right.
that?
So, with a parent, if you've tried all the things, if you've tried everything you know, if you've tried everything your friends know, if you've tried everything your parents, the grandparents, and you've read books and you've tried all the things and nothing is making it better. And in fact, it may be becoming worse. Maybe a child is becoming more withdrawn. Maybe a child is becoming more anxious. Maybe a child is acting out more. Then it really is time to seek some professional help. There are trained clinicians out there who are trained, like I am trained specifically to work with children and their families, because working with a child is different than working with an adult.
And you do play therapy, which to me,
I
that I want to sign up for that. So
do. Yeah, you walk into my room and it looks like Toys R Us.
that's incredible. So what are some signs maybe for parents that your child may, have anxiety, have depression? What is something that if they're not saying it, maybe behavior's not, you're not noticeable, what could we be looking for?
So a lot of things that I tell parents to look for that children don't talk about as much are sleep deprivation. Are they having trouble going to sleep? Are they having trouble staying asleep? Are they waking up during the night and just kind of walking around? Or are they waking up hours before they're supposed to? So look for kind of some sleep deprivation, which is really pretty easy to see in behaviors. But that's the first thing that I tell people about, parents about, is to look at their sleep patterns. Also look at their attachment needs. Are we talking about a child who before felt secure in themselves and in their attachment to their parents, and all of a sudden they're either very clingy and no attachment is enough for them. No
Wow.
communication, no cuddling, no affection is enough for this child to fill their cup. Or conversely, at the opposite end, are we looking at a child who is so withdrawn that they never want to come out of their room? Then those are some kind of some warning signs. We tend to see depression go more towards the withdrawing, even in children, and we tend to see anxiety go more towards the clingy and more hyperactive behavior. Although that can be deceiving, because in children, a lot of times depression looks more anxious because it'll come with a more hyperactive element to it.
Wow, that's fascinating. Let's say We're going to be hypothetical here. If you had a teenage child who asked to go to therapy,
yes.
How would you deal with that?
Okay, so having a teenager ask to go to therapy is actually not a very uncommon thing in where we live today.
Yeah.
You know, therapy is very commercialized. Everybody knows somebody who's going to therapy. Most people have gone to therapy, which I think can be a very positive thing. But they talk to their friends and they're diagnosing themselves with disorders. And they're coming to you saying, I need to go to therapy. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean that therapy is a bad thing. I think what you have is a teenager who is feeling that something is off and feeling that something is wrong and is trying to figure out what it is, just like as adults, we like to fix things.
Yeah.
Well, teenagers do too. And so they're trying to figure out what it is, and the feedback they're getting is that therapy helps.
Which is, I mean, that sounds positive. And so I think I appreciate you speaking to that. And so we started this series. I introduced my therapist. I'm a year into actually seeing somebody, you know, a man who finally asked for some directions and some help. And it's been very beneficial. Yeah.
But I think people often come to therapy thinking it's going to be like a quick fix. And therapy doesn't necessarily have to take months and months to get better. There's a lot of theories out there that you really can't see a significant change within 2 or 3 sessions, depending on what you're coming in for and the model that the therapist is using. But there is, if I had a magic pill,
yes,
that fixed everything, I would be retired and living off of my income.
That's right. I'm glad we said that. So I'm glad I lost my train of thought, and it trained you to say that, because, and then it reminded of me. So as people who've been watching the show, the podcast, get to meet my therapist, and I go in quite often, and I have diagnosed something else about myself through ChatGPT. That seems like something, like as a parent, and you're trying to figure out now with, you know, you always had to be able to Google it. You could Google it and find something, but now with AI chat, I mean,
oh, yeah,
you can
I
dig
have
in
teenagers
pretty deep.
Who come in who understand the DSM diagnosis better than I do after 20 years in school.
So what kind of advice would you have for a parent, or maybe even their teenager, in diagnosing themselves before seeing someone?
Well, it's the same thing that your doctor tells you, right? Don't
right.
Google it.
Right.
That while we may fit the black and white definition of what the criteria is for a certain diagnosis, that doesn't mean that you actually fit that criteria, that there's more that goes in the process and there's more of the communication that needs to occur than just the black and white yes or no.
Thank you for that. So you are, you know, a faithful believer. And I think a lot of times, to me, trying to figure out as a Christian how to approach therapy, especially with our children, what kind of advice towards Christian parents would you have in finding someone or trusting someone to work with their child?
Sure. First of all, I would say that the most difficult thing an individual ever does, or one of the most difficult, is to actually walk into the therapy office for the first time. That is an incredibly difficult thing to do. However, that's compounded when you're bringing your child into therapy for the first time. That's even more difficult to do because you really don't have the control, because you're seeing someone who's going to see your child and you're not even in the room.
No.
And the door is going to close. And then the therapist is going to tell you generalities that are happening.
Right.
But they are not going to tell you everything, because we're going to protect the confidentiality of a child as much as possible, as well as an adult. And so there's a lot of bravery that comes with that act, a lot of courage that takes you to walk in. And I've been on both sides. I've been into therapy myself, and I've also taken my children to a clinician before. So I have felt those things as well. So first of all, acknowledge that you're going to feel some fear. And that you're going to feel some uncertainty is kind of the first thing that I would say. Second thing I would say would be to do some research. And by research, I don't necessarily mean getting online, although that can be a good thing. But I think the best way to find a therapist for a child is to talk to your friends and see if they've ever had to take their therapist or their child to a therapist. Have they ever had to use therapy themselves? Have they felt like they've had success? Have they felt like they've had a connection with a clinician? Because at the end of the day, how much you know and how talented you are as a clinician is not as important as the relationship you're going to develop with that individual. That is the most important thing about therapy. It's also shown in research over and over and over as the primary indicator of if therapy is going to be successful is what's called therapeutic client, therapeutic relationship. That's the most important thing. If you go to a therapist and you don't feel comfortable with them, go to someone else. There's lots of them out there. Yeah. And a professional should not in any way, shape, or form be offended by the fact that we're not quite clicking. I know I can't be everything for everybody.
Yeah.
And so if somebody comes to me and it's not quite clicking, oftentimes I will bring it up or they will bring it up and we'll talk about it for a few minutes. But guess what? I also have a lot of clinicians I know who are really good.
Yeah.
I can refer to. So, you know, rely on that referral system. Again, if you don't know anybody who's been in therapy before, or you don't know a clinician yourself, then start with the internet. But just be willing, you know, go in there and kind of that intake interview, kind of have in mind that it's an interview for you as well as it is for the clinician, and to treat it as such.
I'm glad we said that. I think that's a very helpful advice there. So you've given us some great practical advice on how to look for, you know, maybe anxiety in our children, what to do about going towards therapy. But what is something that we could do today in our families to help our children with anxiety?
Sure. I say this to every person who walks in my door professionally, but the thing that I keep coming back to is connection is king. So it doesn't matter what we do as much as if we're doing it in a connected way. And what I mean by that is actually be present with your child.
Yeah.
When you're talking to them, are your toes and your nose facing the child? Or are you trying to do something and looking over your shoulder and just kind of like, you know, it feels brushed off? Connect with your child. Put down your own devices and actually have a conversation. If your child doesn't want to talk, just sit next to them. Just have connection with them. That is the biggest advice that I can give that makes an almost immediate impact. The second thing that I think is important, and this was brought out in the book, is that there are things that you can do to kind of help negate anxiety. And these are things that a clinician will work with you. But things like having a routine, and by routine, I mean like actually having a Bible study together, actually sitting down as a family and soaping out a verse of scripture, or talking about a sermon, or talking about a Sunday school lesson. Or when a child comes to you with a problem, talking about not only how they feel about that, but what does God then say about that? Because we're no longer in a situation where we can hope for others to instill our children with faith.
Yes.
That has to come from us.
Yes, incredible. I think toes and nose is going to become a mantra in my household. I love that. And as you're saying that, I'm like, oh, I got to turn my toes now to you. I didn't have my toes turned to you. My nose was there. My toes weren't. Temple, I can't thank you enough. I get to hang with your husband, Dan, quite often. And I think a lot of you guys. And it was good to visit with you today.
Okay. Thank you, Jake.
You've been listening to Stand Firm Parents. Stand Firm Parents is a production of Stand Firm Ministries in partnership with LifeWord Studios, created by Jake McCandless and Brandon Harrington of Dime Collective. Again, thank you for listening, and be sure to subscribe, share, and most importantly, stand firm.